Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to arm each and every member of the crew of the Enterprise with a gas bill and an electricity bill, to build we'll go where no man has gone before. Captain Albert, stardate 2468.
Who do we appreciate?
M-I-S-T-E-R-S-E-O-C-K.
Mr. Spock!
Three cheers for Mr. Spock.
Hooray!
Now, please, everyone, please, quiet, please. You must forgive the exuberance of my crew. It's just that they are all so grateful to our Vulcan friend for coming up with the idea which will once again enable us to go on a mission without being interrupted by a radio show. For all we need do before setting out on our mission is simply to wait until the said radio show is over, as we just have. A brilliant, if simple, idea. But then, often the most brilliant ideas are simple. But exactly how Spock conceived such a brilliant idea is quite beyond me. Maybe one day he will explain.
Simple, Jim.
Go on then, Spock.
Go on what?
Were you not about to explain to me how you conceived your brilliant idea?
No.
Then why, when I said how Mr. Spock conceived such a brilliant idea is quite beyond me, maybe one day he will explain, did you say, simple, Jim?
Because I am of the opinion that you are simple.
And why do you think that, Mr. Spock?
Simple, Jim.
Spock, I command you to stop calling me simple.
No, I wasn't calling you simple then, Jim. I said simple, Jim, then, because the explanation as to why I think you are simple is a simple one.
Ah. But when you say simple, Jim, how am I to know whether you are saying that the explanation of something is simple or whether you are calling me simple?
Simple, Jim.
Ah. Simple when you know, isn't it?
Simple, Jim.
And now, Mr. Spock, if you would be so good as to let me continue with my Captain's Albert. Our mission is to discover why a cat has nine lives. And to find this out, we are on course for the planet Moggy, that most calm and stress-free of planets in the constellation of Mogadon. Once ensconced on Moggy, our plan is to...
Captain, one of our men found this in one of the air intakes.
A small piece of some sort of organic matter. Have you any idea what this is, Mr. Scott?
I'm not sure, Captain, but feel it. It's so soft.
Yes.
It's so very soft, and smooth and velvety. What's it remind you of, sir?
Uhura's bottom. I'm sure I don't know, Mr. Scott. What does it remind you of?
A cat, sir.
A cat?
I think this is a piece of cat fur, sir.
But it can't be, Scotty. We're at least a week away from the planet Moggy.
Oh, no, we're not, Captain. Listen.
You're right, Uhura. It appears that we are indeed in the vicinity of Moggy.
That's the orange, sir. It's changed. It now sounds as if the cats are in great pain.
Yes, that means we must have entered the neutering zone. Ah, good. We're through it. Mr. Sulu, prepare to land on Moggy.
Aye, aye, Captain. Captain Kirk, Captain Kirk, we have suddenly come to a dead stop in space.
Mr. Spock, an explanation as to why the Enterprise has suddenly come to a dead stop?
Simple, Jim.
Do you mean that I'm simple or that the explanation is simple?
I mean, Jim, that we have landed on a planet in the constellation of Dromedana.
But Moggy is in Mogadon, not Dromedana, Spock. And if we are not on Moggy, then what is all that meowing we can hear?
A rehearsal for the musical Cats.
Cats?
An off-Broadway production.
But, Spock, we are hundreds of millions of miles away from Earth in the constellation of Dromedana.
Well, that's off-Broadway, isn't it?
Spock?
Yes?
Don't be such a prat.
Prat I may be, Jim, but it was I who came up with the idea which enabled us to go on missions without their being interrupted by a radio show, was it not?
Actually, you never got around to telling me, Spock. How did you come up with the idea?
Simple, Jim.
Do you mean that I'm simple?
I mean that I got the idea when the knob fell off my personal radio. In sticking it back on, I accidentally switched it on like this, see?
No!
And I believe, Mr. Crawford, from...
Michael.
I believe, from what I've read in the newspapers, that your role in the new Lloyd Webber musical, Buncombe, will be an extremely exacting one.
Oh, extremely.
Yes, my performance as Barnum was an absolute breeze compared to the amount of energy I'll use up doing Buncombe. In fact, I've had to go into very strict training for it.
Really?
Yes, yes. Not only am I on stage for the entire 6 hours of each performance of Buncombe, but I also have to spend 12 hours a day putting on the makeup which transforms my face into a grotesque mask.
Well, as long as that, eh?
Well, it is the part of Andrew Lloyd Webber that I'm playing.
And indeed, Buncombe is more or less the story of Lloyd Webber's life, I believe.
That's right, Betty. Basically, the story of an immensely talented young composer who gives new and original music to everybody in the world. And then Andrew comes along and takes it back off them. I've got a tape of part of Act One if you'd like to hear it.
Oh, yes, please.
It's the bit where Andrew has just met the struggling Tim Rice.
Oh, stop struggling, Tim, and give us a kiss.
Look, it's no good, Andrew. We're just going to have to get an actress to play the part of your girlfriend in this musical you're writing. Andrew? Oh, God, he's off into cloud cuckoo land again.
I can't help it, Tim. You see, I've got this really, really useful original song going round my head.
Yes, but why have you got the words to As Long As He Needs Me written on your hatband?
Well, you see, I'm hoping that the close proximity of the words will permeate through into my brain, and then, as well as being able to write great music, I'll be able to write great lyrics too, and then fame.
Look, why don't you just leave the lyric writing to me?
But you can write lyrics, Tim.
Listen to this. My heart is in tune with my baby's, even though her dog has got rabies. Even though her dog has got rabies, and it bit her, and now she's got rabies. No doubts or maybes, my baby's got rabies. Then my baby bit me, so maybe rabies, I've got you. 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 Maybe rabies, we've got rabies too.
Oh! Oh, yes. Super, super, I like it. And thinking about dogs has given me a really, really useful original idea, Tim. Why don't you and me get together and write a musical all about earwigs?
Earwigs?
Oh, yes, I'm sure we can do it, Tim. I can just visualize the opening. A perfectly black stage, midnight, not a sound from the compost heap. And then all of a sudden, we can hear these hundreds of earwigs. And then from out of this cacophony, the earwigs going to the opening number.
Oh, yes. Here we go, here we go, here we go.
Oh, terrific, Tim. Really, really useful and terrific.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm earwigs. I think we should go for something more cuddly and sensuously sexy.
You're right. Slugs. Or cats. Yes, cats. I can just visualize the opening. A perfectly black stage. Midnight. Not a sound from the pavement. And then, all of a sudden, we can hear these hundreds of cats.
We're meowing, sir. It's changed. It sounds now as if the cats are in great pain.
Yes, that means we must have entered the neutering. Hold on. Hold on. We've done this a bit before. What on earth is going on?
Well, actually, we're not on Earth, Captain Crouch.
Quiet, Scotty. How can we... Yes, of course. For some unaccountable reason, we must have traveled back several minutes in time, and we are now back at the point in our mission where we were interrupted by that radio show, which means that we can now continue on with our mission, and this time we won't make the silly mistake of switching our radio on.
No, Jim, you're wrong. Your reasoning is quite illogical. For we could not possibly have traveled back in time.
Travel through time impossible, Spock? But that just cannot be true, because if what you are saying were true, Spock, it would completely and absolutely negate the entire concept of interplanetary space travel as we know it.
Well, tough titty.
Telling argument indeed, Spock. However, you seem to have overlooked something, for if we have indeed not traveled back in time, how is it that I can now hear the meowing sounds I heard several minutes ago?
Simple, Jim.
Do you mean that...
I mean, Jim, that you can still hear meowing because my radio is still switched on and they're doing a sketch about the musical Cats. And if you don't mind, I'd now like to carry on listening to it.
But Spock...
And then, from out of this cacophony, Tim, the cats go into the opening number.
Felines... nothing more than feline. Trying to forget.
Terrific, Tim, terrific. Really, really useful and terrific. And I've got this really, really useful original tune that I composed, which will fit in wonderfully. Listen.
Sure. Especially about that last bit. Once the audience hear that, they'll get up and leave. The sort of stuff you write, we're going to have enough trouble getting them to stay until the end as it is.
Oh, you really, really...
Oh, I was enjoying that, Michael.
Yes, it's not bad, is it? A bit rough at the edges yet, but I'm sure it'll be all right on the night.
Thank you, Michael Crawford, and good luck with the show.
Love you.
My next guest is someone who could well follow in the footsteps of his namesakes, Des O'Connor and Tom O'Connor, a young comedian who goes by the name of Ted Marshall, who in fact was christened Ted O'Connor, but changed his name to give himself a sporting chance. So, oh, excuse me. Well, why not? Oh. Ah, well, apparently somebody with impeccable taste has just shot him. So, instead we're going to continue with our investigation into hospital maternity wards. And to discuss them, I should now have an obstetrician with me, but thanks to a particularly inept production assistant who couldn't read my writing, I now have an obese electrician with me. But as he was present at the birth when one of his own children departed the womb, and as he's put a couple of light bulbs in for us, in the studio, I mean, I don't mean... and as we weren't able to get anyone else at such short notice, you'll be hearing what he has to say after this recording, which we made last week at a London hospital.
I said go away.
Oh, but why not, Doctor? I mean, why can't I?
Go away.
Oh, it's not fair. You let other men into the maternity ward to share the wonderful experience of childbirth with their wives. You let other men in. So why won't you let me in to share the wonderful experience?
Because you haven't got a wife in there, have you?
I have. Look, and the very last thing she said to me before she got in the ambulance was, "Darling," she said, "I want you to promise me that you'll be at the hospital to share the wonderful experience with me."
And the name of your wife?
Jones. Mrs. Jones.
We don't have a Mrs. Jones.
Oh, Evans, I mean. Mrs. Evans.
Or a Mrs. Evans. The only prospective mother in the ward at the moment is one Mrs. Oppenheimer Heckmond wife.
Oh, that's her. Mrs. Oppenheimer, what's her name? It's just a slip of the tongue when I said Jones. And Evans. Look, well, good. I'm glad that little misunderstanding has been cleared up, so if you just let me pass, Doctor.
Go away.
Look, Doctor, I tell you what. How would it be if I was a surrogate husband? Yeah, I mean, that's the answer, isn't it? Look, because there must be some woman somewhere who wants to share the wonderful experience with her husband, but her husband doesn't fancy it.
For the last time, will you please go away?
So, you're not going to allow me to share the wonderful experience then?
No, I am not.
Well, can I watch you lance somebody's boil then?
Look, have I to call the police?
There is no need for that.
Look, I'm going to call the police.
Oh, blast. Somebody always comes to the door when there's something interesting on the radio. Yes, what do you want?
Good evening. I'm from the Parasite Insurance Company. You phone...
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, you better come in.
Thank you.
We present the 17th minute of the show. Will you please welcome tonight's guest, Miss Victoria Wood.
I was Catherine, the other Monday. Oh, yes, it was Monday. I remember. It was the same morning I woke up and thought I'd lost my boobs. And then I realised I hadn't lost them. They just joined up with a midriff bulge. But I like that bulge, aren't they? Once you get a bit older, they start to move about of their own free will. I remember once mine moved down the back, and very tricky it was, too. Because I was hiking in the Lake District at the time, and my rucksack was already full. And there were my boobs vying for space with my survival blanket, a primer stove, and a tin of pineapple chunks. Anyway, as I was saying, I was thinking, I'm really grateful that my parents are called Mr. and Mrs. Wood. Well, no, really, I mean, just imagine if they'd been called Mr. and Mrs. Embankment. Because then I'd be called Victoria Embankment, and I don't think... I'd like being Victoria Embankment. I mean, people chuck things on Victoria Embankment, don't they? Like Coca-Cola tins, strawberry yogurt cartons, fag ends. And I can do without having fag ends thrown on me and setting me on fire because I'm trying to give up smoking. In fact, I don't really fancy having anything thrown on me, except maybe Robert Redford. But I don't think Robert Redford goes down Victoria Embankment all that often. Even worse than being called Victoria Embankment would be if my parents had been called Station. Because if I were called Victoria Station, I would smell really awful and the trains would always be arriving late at me. And I have tramps bedding down on me for the night, and I can do without having a tramp lying on me, thank you very much, unless Robert Redford has become a tramp, and it was him, and then I wouldn't know. You probably gather that I like Robert Redford quite a lot, well, I do. But even so, I could never marry him, because his real name is Robert and Albert Museum, and if I married him, I'd be Victoria and Albert Museum, wouldn't I? And I'd feel daft. So on the whole, I'm rather glad I'm called Victoria Wood. There isn't a wood called Victoria Wood, is there?
Miss Victoria Wood, ladies and gentlemen. Miss Victoria Wood, or as she is now known since the birth of her baby, Victoria Did. It's back for the man from the Parasite Insurance Company.
So then, you want to take out some insurance cover, I believe, Mr. Blenkinsop.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I want to insure against the wife winning the Miss World contest.
Insure against your wife winning the Miss World contest?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
That's your wife sitting over there, is it? The bald lady.
What?
That's your wife, the bald lady with the squint.
Oh, yes. That's Mirabelle. Mirabelle, come over here, would you? Say hello to this gentleman.
Hello.
Yeah, this is my wife, Mirabelle the Body Blenkinsop.
Oh, well, why is she known as the Body?
Well, she tried to dig her grandfather up, you see.
With no coal!
But she can't burn.
Charlie was called Pete!
Terrible sense of humour she's got. Terrible. Ah, so then, how much will the premium be, eh? To insure against Mirabelle winning the Miss World contest?
I mean, if you don't mind me saying so, Mr. Blenkinsop, you see... The Miss World contest is ostensibly a beauty competition. Well, I'm not saying that your wife isn't... I mean...
She's ugly.
Well, I wouldn't go so far.
No, it's all right. She knows she's ugly. I'm always telling her. Here, listen. Mirabelle, you're ugly.
I'm ugly.
There you are.
Well, you've probably got a lovely personality to compensate.
What? No, she hasn't. She's got a rotten personality. Right cow, she is.
I'm a right cow!
Told you.
Yes, well, as I was saying, a prime consideration in the Miss World contest is beauty and...
Listen, Mirabelle does things that will impress the judges, you see. She does a lot for birds.
I'm very kind to birds.
In what way?
She doesn't look at them. And she goes down very big in the bit where the host interviews the contestants. I mean, well, listen to this. I'm the host, all right? I'm the host. Mirabelle is Mirabelle. Now, tell me, Mirabelle, what do you want to do with your life?
I want to work and privilege children and help to handicap old people.
Work with underprivileged children and help handicapped old people, you stupid mick.
I think I'd rather do
that. Yeah, I know you would. But look, how are you going to win the Miss World contest if you... Where are you going?
I'm putting it on the telly. It's time for Body Matters, and I always watch it.
I'll keep telling you, Mirabelle, they don't dig up bodies on Body Matters. It's about...
Well, I like it anyway. I agree with what they say. Look after your body, they say, and your body will look after you.
Well, yours hasn't.
Well, I'm still watching it.
To another edition of Body Matters. My name is Graham Garden, and tonight, in fact, I'm going to be talking about how comic actors like me, once they become established on television, can pick up some very easy money, thank you very much, for fronting programs such as this one.
My name is Gillian Rice, and as usual, I, in fact, will be talking to you as if I'm auditioning for a job on Play School.
And my name is Alan Marion Davis, and in fact, I will be talking to you about what great fun all three of us have doing a show which trivializes medicine.
And in fact, all three of us will also be saying, in fact, quite a lot when we're discussing our subject for tonight, which is...
hemorrhoids. Not one of the more pleasant complaints, in fact.
But, in fact, an illness, nevertheless, about which we get literally piles of letters.
And it is precisely because we are tackling the problem of hemorrhoids that the entire 300 members of our studio audience tonight are, in fact, all hemorrhoids sufferers.
And a very appreciative audience they are, too, in fact.
As when we met them just before we came on the air, they, in fact, gave us a standing ovation.
Well, in fact, they just gave us an ovation. They were already standing because they all suffer from hemorrhoids. But now, as it is, in fact, time to start the show, I'm now going to ask them all to sit down. So, studio audience, on the command, sit, I want you all to sit down. One, two. Wait for it. Three. Sit. Oh.
Now, are you all sitting uncomfortably?
Yes.
Then, in fact, we'll in fact begin, in fact.
But not, in fact, about hemorrhoids.
Because, in fact, we have tricked you. Because our program tonight is not... in fact, about hemorrhoids, but about the subject of pain.
And the reason why we've got 300 hemorrhoid sufferers in our audience tonight is so that we can, in fact, demonstrate how pain works.
And that's right. Because if, for example, you cut your finger, it wouldn't, in fact, hurt you until your brain told you that it was hurting you.
In other words, if you didn't have a brain to tell you that something was hurting you, then it wouldn't, in fact, hurt you.
I've got a brain. So, when I drop this 56-pound weight on my foot, it should hurt me. Here goes. Ah! Yes, it did. But, in fact, perceived pain is not always real.
Pain can be imagined, in fact.
And to prove that statement, I, in fact, have with me in the audience someone who has a particularly bad case of hemorrhoids, who is going to help us with a little experiment. Your name is Mr. Des Gomersall, I believe, sir.
No, it's Danny Seddon. And this is my wife,
Fanny. We come here to look at your... giant models of internal organs, haven't we, Danny?
Giant models, internal.
I say, Danny, what's that funny-looking internal organ? What's that one, that peculiar shape one?
Oh, that's Gillian Rice.
Oh,
I recognise that one, Fanny, over there. That's an ovary.
Oh. Whereabouts are they on you, Danny?
They're not anywhere on me, Fanny. No, they're women's.
Women's things?
But on you, Fanny, on you. They're just about here, see?
No, they're not, Danny.
Why aren't they?
Because I've had them removed.
Yes, well, thank you, Fanny and Danny. But we must press on. I'm looking for a Mr. Des Gomersall, the gentleman who has, in fact, a particularly bad case of hemorrhoids.
I'm over here in row J, seats 5, 6 and 7.
Well, Des said that because we told him to. And we thought that as well as being funny and joke, it was typical of the patronising manner in which we do this show.
Aptly demonstrating as it does that not only does Des, in fact, suffer from discomfort in his nether regions,
but also that we, too, are a pain in the bum.
And those are the facts. And now, radio, can it have a harmful effect on your ears? Listen to this radio broadcast of the making of Gone with the Wind.
But what is to happen to me, Rat?
Frankly, my dear, I don't...
Go on! What's the matter?
Frankly, my dear, I don't...
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a...
Look, have I got to say this line?
Why, what's wrong with the line?
I don't know. It just doesn't sound right.
Doesn't sound right, Clark? Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Look, I'm the writer of Gone with the Wind. I wrote that line, and I know a good line when I write one.
Why can't I just say goodbye?
Goodbye? What sort of a line is that?
Well, it's more snappy, isn't it?
You are walking out of Scar O'Hara's life forever. The situation doesn't call for a snappy line. It calls for a considered line, an emotive line. Just say the line.
I'll just try goodbye and see how it feels.
Goodbye doesn't make sense, you jerk. Scott says, but what is to happen to me, Red? And you say, goodbye. That doesn't make sense, does it?
I say, perhaps if I were to say, so, this is goodbye, Red.
Take the hell out of it! Well, don't. I've had enough of your suggestion. You were the one who suggested that we should change the name of your house from Tara to Dunslavin, weren't you?
We have Dunslavin, haven't we?
Shut up! Now look, Gable, just say the line.
But I don't like the line.
You don't like the line? You don't? Listen, pup. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. It's the best exit line I ever wrote. That line will go down in the annals of film history. It is a great line.
Perhaps if I were to say, frankly, my pig, I don't give a damn.
Frankly, my pig?
You know, another sort of animal instead of a deer.
Are you for real?
I'll play around with it. Frankly, my rhinoceros, I don't give a damn. Frankly, my armadillo, I don't give a damn. Frankly, my reticulated python, I don't give a damn.
You know, I think he might have something there.
You think he might have something there?
Yes.
The guy who wanted to flood Atlanta with a 100-foot-high tidal wave.
Look, as director of this film, I still think a tidal wave would be far more spectacular than a fire.
Atlanta is 250 miles from the sea, you ninman.
Now, look, if you're going to split hairs, I mean...
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a stegosaurus. No, not keen on that. Besides, it's extinct.
Look, please, will you just say, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Look, how would it be if I said, frankly, my dear, I don't give a grand coulee?
A grand coulee? What the hell's a grand coulee?
It's a dam. I'd settle for that.
Well, I won't.
Hey, I got it. How about if he said, play it again, Sam.
Play it again, Sam?
You heard me. Play it again, Sam.
Well, sure. Sure thing, Rick.
Wouldn't you just know it? Here's old Rick thinking how he's got away with having to do this show anymore, and then they dragged me in again just because the writer couldn't think of a tag for the Gone with the Wind sketch. But this is all I'm doing. I'm drawing the line of talking between the end credits like they had me doing on the last series. And I hope that's clearly understood, Mr. Announcer.
Oh, yes, of course, Rick.
So what are you waiting for? Get on with it.
Yes, right. You have been listening to Star Trek 2, starring Christopher Godwin, Jeffrey Holland, Susie Blake, and Fred Harris.
You have been secretly listening to Star Trek 2, starring Christopher No Such Thing as Godwin, Jeffrey Holland next after Afghanistan, Susie Blakeover, and Fred Legover.
The show is written by Terry Ravenscroft.
Subversive material by Terry Ravenscroft.
And produced by Martin Fisher.
And illegally broadcast by Martin Midnight Knock Fisher.
Thank you.